Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As children's participation in organized sports has increased over the years, so have related injuries, as many as half of which are the result of overuse of joints and muscles. Now, professional trainers have issued a set of warnings to parents. Thomas Pommering is a doctor of osteopathic medicine, a division chief for sports medicine, and a medical director for Nationwide Children's Sports Medicine. Welcome back.
Hey, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So the National Athletic Trainers Association recommends that child athletes take at least 2 days off a week and not play a single sport for more than 8 months a year. What are your thoughts about single sport kids?
Yeah, so this is a call that's come out from several medical organizations over the last couple years trying to help reduce overuse injuries in kids. And the suggestions that they put out are really what we will help us do that. Kids will do better if they can have a chance to rest their sore bones and muscles at least a couple days a week. We know that time is really important, not only just for repairing injured tissue, but also for helping them realize the training that they've done to help it turn into stronger bones and muscles. So that's really important to have a couple days off. And then, two, it's really good to delay specialization in sport as long as you really can, so that, again, kids aren't using the same muscle groups, doing the same activity year-round, and that's been shown to be helpful as well.
There seems to be conflicting messages, though, right, from coaches, from organizations, sports organization teams, that kind of a thing. They seem to want you to be doing hockey year-round or going to a camp in the summer or something, not taking time off.
Yeah, parents are really in a tough position right now because I think that the culture of many of these sports is to start earlier and go longer and to specialize as soon as you can. And parents really are under the impression that this will lead to their kids being better down the road, being more competitive, being able to compete for positions on their high school teams or colleges or even beyond. And really, research has shown when you look back at past Olympians and past elite athletes for most sports, kids who specialize later were still able to win medals and achieve the highest level of their sport without compromising their ability to be good. So I think parents don't always hear that or get that side of the message that specializing late in most sports, not all, but most sports, does not compromise their ability to be successful.
The National Athletic Trainers Association's new recommendations are considered more detailed and rigorous than those issued by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which in 2012, so granted it was 7 years ago, recommended a day off every week and a month off from sports every year. Not quite as much. What do you make of that? Or do you think that pediatricians are going to be catching up with their own recommendations soon?
Yeah, I think that for some of our other organizations that have pediatrician membership, that they have already caught up to these recommendations and are recommending them. I think sometimes these official statements take a little bit longer to come out. And also, sometimes if your recommendations aren't working, you need to update them. So I think that this is still what the National Athletic Training Association has put out is still relevant and important. And again, the message isn't getting through to parents. And so I think it's good to kind of regenerate this message and get it back out there to parents.
Don't the leagues have rules about, say, how long a kid can be on the pitcher's mound, that kind of a thing?
There are a few recommendations that are out there for very specific activities, such as pitching. But really, we can't control how many warm-up pitches they have, how many teams they pitch on, whether they're pitching in the off season. So there's some other things, especially for pitching, that we know from good research that shows if they can just not throw anything for a couple of months a year, their chances of needing to have a surgery on their elbow or shoulder, which could be career-ending or career-threatening, goes way down. So those types of messages are out there, but they're not being really probably parents aren't hearing that as much as they are. You got to start early and get a good coach and get good as fast as you can.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As I said, the National Athletic Trainers Association has issued a new set of recommendations regarding the kind of exercise and kids' participation in organized sports. My guest is Dr. Thomas Pommering. He's the Division Chief for Sports Medicine and the Medical Director for Nationwide Children's Sports Medicine. If you have a question about what your kids should do and what you're hearing, do you feel like you're getting conflicting recommendations, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Pommering, is it the training or the competition or both?
So it's really both. So I think the other thing parents should understand is I think the perceived upside of specializing early and playing year-round is that they think their kids will achieve really high competence quickly. But there's a downside to that type of intense year-round pressure. One is, you know, physical and emotional burnout in sport. And when we look at this as well, we look back, you know, from past Olympians and past elite athletes, the kids that were less likely to burn out early and quit their sport, even if they were high-achieving athletes, were ones that had more control over their schedules. They had more positive coaching experiences. They had time away from their sport. So I think parents don't realize that sometimes, you know, I'm sure parents are trying to do the best thing for their kids, but they may not realize that intensity can actually have a negative consequence down the road.
Is there a sense, or do you have a sense about what kind of warning signs there are for parents if their kids, sometimes kids won't complain. You don't know.
You're absolutely right. I mean, kids really want to please their coaches and their parents and the expectations that they perceive that are, you know, being placed on them. So things that parents can look for are, and again, it's always best when the motivation to play their sport comes intrinsically from the kids and not from the parents and coaches. So when kids start to sort of not want to go to practice, they're late getting ready, they're not paying attention during the practice or the contest, and they're distracted, or if they start to complain about vague things like, you know, vague joint pain, belly pain, things like that, you should start to be concerned that this is really their way of saying, you know, I need a break, or I'm not really into this as much as I used to be.
And what is a good age to consider specialization?
So no one knows the true answer for that, and that's why I think the NATA recommendation was as long as possible. But I think a reasonable sort of recommendation that most of us agree is at least if you can try to hold off until the middle school age. And there's the other advantage of sampling lots of different sports is that kids who do that are actually really good at reading the game. So you might think that playing the same sport year-round makes you an expert on kind of understanding strategy and reading what's going to happen next, but we've actually seen just the opposite in research. Kids who sample different sports have a much better sort of sports awareness than kids who don't.
There's another thing. I know just in general with physical fitness, if you keep doing the same muscles day after day after day after day, you don't have the same effect as if you're changing it up.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely true. You know, overusing or highly utilizing the same muscle and bone group day after day does for sure put you at risk for overuse injuries such as stress fractures, strains and sprains, and even more serious injuries. You know, there are things that we never used to see in children 20 years ago. We didn't see rotator cuff tears. We didn't see the need for Tommy John surgeries in elbows. We didn't see ACL tears in kids. And now when you're playing at a really high level all year, your exposure or your risk for those injuries goes up. And so I think that's another thing parents don't always realize.
I mean, we know we've talked about the concussion issue with the contact sports and that kind of a thing. But is there a sport that you just love to see kids get involved in that may not bring glory and fame, but keeps them physically fit?
So, I mean, the answer to that is really, what do the kids really love? So there's no one sport I think it's really, what are they motivated to do? And I think it's really good for them to try, especially when they're young in grade school age, try different sports because there may be something that a child really will enjoy and will be successful at. But if they've never tried it, you'll never know. So I think it's kind of good to also, if you're, to not do a running sport every season. Now, you know, that doesn't hold true for everyone, but if it's nice, if like say you're a swimmer in the winter and you're a soccer player in the summer and you're a baseball player in the spring, it's nice to sort of balance that out.
You know, a lot of the injuries that you've been referring to, it sounds like they're coming from things like baseball, that kind of a thing.
The throwing injuries, yes, but the other, all the stress fractures, the overuse injuries, and the ACL tears are coming from most sports that involve running and cutting.
Like football, track, that kind of thing?
Yeah, they don't have to be contact, but more like soccer, basketball, football as well.
Are you concerned that coaches aren't about their ability to respond if they see, you know, maybe the technique isn't safe, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, so I think a good message for parents is that the coaching, world is a little bit like the Wild West. There are great coaches out there, and there are coaches that aren't experienced yet. So I think when you're starting to sort of get your kids into higher any level of sport, but especially when you're getting into the higher level sports, make sure that you do your research on the coach. Make sure you have the same philosophies about what's important, and make sure their coaching style kind of meets what you need. That doesn't mean that kids, you know, young athletes can't be pushed and challenged, but it does mean that there is a real art to coaching effectively to get the most out of your kids, to make sure that they're enjoying it and that they're actually improving on their skill, and not it's not just a matter of trying to cultivate toughness.
And I also wanted to talk about how injuries as a child can lead to chronic health problems later in life. Can you give us some examples? You mentioned some of the things where they hurt their elbows, their shoulders, that kind of a thing, but anything else that may not affect them as children but will as adults?
So, you know, that's a good question as well. I mean, luckily, most kids are pretty resilient and heal quickly. So a lot of these injuries we can treat effectively and get them back to an active lifestyle. Now, if they're at a really highly competitive level, these more serious injuries that are involving complicated operations always put kids at risk for not being able to return to that previous level. And then sometimes these injuries can lead to arthritis down the road. But really the worst, I think the biggest risk of pushing kids too hard, too early, is that they just walk away from all sports. They get burned out. And really we want, you know, sports and physical activity should be a lifelong endeavor, we hope. You know, it's a healthy thing to do for kids to be active and to be active adults as well. So we don't want to have that happen to kids where they're so turned off by their experience that they just stop being active as young adults.
And is there something about the physiology of a child that makes them more susceptible to injury?
Yes, for sure. I mean, kids they're often more flexible. They have open growth plates all throughout their body, which are more susceptible to stress and to injury. And I think even just psychologically, I think, you know, they're not really used to being coached like adults. They're not mm-hmm. going to respond the same way as if you're coaching a college athlete.
See, I think about flexibility as an asset.
It is generally an asset, but sometimes flexibility at its extreme can cause joints to dislocate. But for the most part, it's a good thing to have when you're young.
Okay. Well, Dr. Thomas Pommering, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your insights.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Thomas Pommering is Division Chief for Sports Medicine and the Medical Director for Nationwide Children's Sports Medicine. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
StoryCorps shares unscripted conversations between two people about important things in life: love, loss, family, friendship. StoryCorps partnered with WOSU Public Media to record and share the stories of our city. Recorded here, StoryCorps Columbus preserves pieces of our shared history for future generations. Subscribe to the StoryCorps Columbus podcast now at WOSU.org/StoryCorps, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Artificial intelligence could transform the healthcare industry, addressing issues as disparate as physician burnout to underserved rural medicine. AI also could change the approach from curing diseases to staying healthy. And that potential transformation will impact the workforce of the future, from the tail end of the baby boomer generation to Generation Z. WOSU is part of a statewide collaboration of public media broadcasters at work on an initiative called American Graduate, Getting to Work. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports this campaign, and our conversation today builds on a larger conversation about how AI and emerging technologies are changing the healthcare workforce. Mike Milliard is editor of Healthcare IT News. He covers how information and technology are transforming healthcare, with a focus, among other things, on artificial intelligence. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
AI is already being used extensively in the healthcare industry, isn't it?
It is. In a lot of different use cases, a lot of different applications, you know, more than people realize, perhaps.
Like, what don't we see?
It's used in everything from clinical decision support to helping physicians, you know, making smarter decisions about which care and treatments they deliver, predictive models for patient safety, operationally to, you know, detect length of stay for patients or readmissions, in radiology, imaging, cardiology, dermatology, precision medicine, task automation, workflow efficiencies, you know, you name it. It's already transforming healthcare in some fairly substantial ways.
And how is the existing workforce adapting to that? Adapting, I should say.
Well, in varying ways. I think obviously some of the leading edge academic medical centers and, you know, major health systems, your Geisinger's and your Mayo Clinics and Cleveland Clinics of the world are, you know, well ahead of the game. Smaller hospitals are catching up, and, you know, some, there's obviously deep interest and perhaps some trepidation, but I think it's something that more and more organizations are getting used to and are going to have to get used to, because it's really going to be the reality going forward.
Some people, I've heard criticism that doctors are spending too much time staring at a computer screen and not enough time talking to their patients. Is that part of this?
I actually think that's something that this could help with.
Okay.
Yeah, electronic health records, which have kind of come into common usage over the past decade plus or so. I think a lot of physicians feel that it puts a barrier between them and their patients. But smartly deployed artificial intelligence tools, especially things like natural language processing and other applications like that, could help enable the physician, you know, to dictate, you know, directly into the record themselves while maintaining eye contact with the patient, say. Or, you know, generally speaking, I think artificial intelligence could help automate a lot of the tasks that are, you know, the burdensome tasks that are contributing to the clinician burnout you mentioned earlier.
Whenever I talk about AI, I always have to talk about the fact that they're fed, you know, the artificial intelligence is fed algorithms that are produced by mere mortals. And there is an issue with discrimination, with bias, with all kinds of things. Has that emerged in the healthcare field?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there was an article just this past week about a biased algorithm that was actually, you know, there was some racial bias, you know, because the algorithms are only as good as the data that's fed into them. And mm-hmm. So having, you know, well-governed and accurate and, you know, data with integrity is a key building block if AI is going to work correctly and safely.
Can AI also then ask those same questions about, wait a minute, where's this data? Where's it coming from? Is it balanced data? Is it good data?
Yeah, I've seen some, you know, some reporting and have heard for some folks in my reporting that is something that AI can help with, you know, with data integrity as we move forward. Clearly, it's already fairly well evolved, the AI and machine learning, you know, algorithms, but I think it's only going to become more advanced and intuitive in the years ahead.
What are the thoughts in the healthcare industry about who should be training the workforce for, I say the changes, but for adapting to this, the industry or educational institutions? Where does the responsibility for that lie?
I think it kind of lies with everyone. It's just, you know, like, you know, healthcare was relatively slow compared to with other industries to digitize and, you know, to get on board with information technology. And I think with AI, it's just going to have to be an industry-wide effort to kind of get up to speed with some of the stuff and learn how to, you know, deploy it effectively. And so that's where an organization such as HIMSS, which is, you know, the parent company of Healthcare IT News, you know, helps with, you know, education and thought leadership and engaging with the industry to help, you know, people who are trying to figure some of this stuff out, you know, make the most of it.
So now you're saying it's practically everywhere in healthcare. What are the implications for the emerging workforce? Because when their parents started in, you know, in the healthcare business, for instance, none of it was there.
I think it depends on what type of role you're doing, for instance. I mean, I think when it comes to clinicians, as I mentioned, I think it can help in a big way with clinician burnout and helping kind of take some of the, you know, burden from these onerous, you know, documentation rules that they need to deal with and, you know, workflow challenges that may be a bit wonky, you know, it can help automate some of those processes and help them focus on, you know, practicing at the top of their license and helping, you know, restore some of the joy of medicine, you know, that they got into this in the first place. I think it's just going to, and again, it really depends on how it's deployed and how sound the strategy is with regard to, you know, how health systems roll this stuff out. But I think in general, it can help with efficiencies and enable people to do work at a more value-added level, so to speak.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the role of AI in the healthcare industry. My guest is Mike Milliard. He's editor of Healthcare IT News. If you have a question about, you know, how it's changing the workforce going forward, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I mean, let's face it, the healthcare industry, Mike, is gigantic in the United States. This is not just some narrow field of study that's undergoing this transformation.
No, it's big. It's got also has some big challenges, which I think the hope is that some of these tools can help address.
So you said natural language processing. That's so that doctors don't have to write everything down. They can just dictate.
Sure. That's part of it. Yep.
What else?
Healthcare is facing a big physician shortage and nursing shortage. Some of this stuff could be put to work with remote patient monitoring, telemedicine, you know, monitoring several ICUs at once, perhaps with you know, human supervision, of course. There's a lot of ways where task automation could help address some of the, you know, staffing and you know, workforce short challenges that healthcare faces.
So you say human supervision, of course, and you kind of chuckled, but some people worry that, no, in the future, there won't be that much human supervision, that too much will be given over to AI.
Well, again, I think that's an important – that's a concern for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that people need to be vigilant about. AI is often described as this kind of black box where, you know, data goes in and data comes out and nobody really knows the magic that happens inside. So I think there's been a push, you know, for more regulation about how those algorithms are developed and what sort of visibility there is into how they work. You know, as I mentioned, there's some bias inherent if the data is not ideally, you know, governed or error, you know, has integrity. So, you know, these are questions that I think, you know, have to be sorted out, and it's going to be a long and iterative process as people get used to this and more people, you know, become accustomed to what it can do and some of the challenges involved, some of the risks. And I think humans are obviously going to have to play an active role in ensuring that this is deployed safely and effectively.
You mentioned long-distance medicine, remote patient monitoring, that kind of a thing. Are there other areas that AI is getting involved in? I mean, is it in the surgery, for instance?
Yes, there's definitely some AI-enabled, AI-assisted robotic surgery that goes on.
And is it common?
I'm not sure how common it is. To be honest, I don't cover robotic surgeries like Da Vinci, you know, robots or that as often as I do information technology per se.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that it is it's not uncommon, perhaps.
I read that the technology of artificial intelligence and its kind of ancillary applications in healthcare are changing so rapidly that traditional educational institutions won't be able to keep up. That there's a need for the medical institutions to take more of a role in that.
Certainly, and you know, there's initiatives underway. You know, the American Medical Association has this Medical School of the Future program that's trying to kind of update the way that medical schools are instructing physicians, you know, future physicians, you know, to deal with some of these technologies, not just kind of basic electronic health records, but, you know, get them up to speed with, you know, the nuances involved in artificial intelligence, machine learning, get them, you know, conversant in some of the concepts of, you know, emerging, you know, fields such as precision medicine, personalized, you know, treatments. So there's a lot of learning that has to be done across the board.
And are there new jobs out there because of this, or will there be?
I think so. I think as it frees up folks on the healthcare side to do more creative work, I think it's going to enable some people to rethink the way that some of these jobs are done, and new roles will emerge that allow more of a human touch, I think, to healthcare.
Hmm. And what about the cost? I mean, obviously, the United States is well known for its high-priced healthcare. It's super expensive. Is there a sense that AI lowers the cost, maintains it? Any sense about that?
Hopefully. I mean, I think when investments are made, you know, with sound strategy and you know, foresight in mind, and, you know, there's, as noted in the article, there's revenue cycle management, for instance, is a major concern, obviously, for health systems and how they get paid and reimbursed. But revenue process automation and, you know, other forms of artificial intelligence that can help automate those payment processes could drive efficiencies. As I mentioned on the clinical side, you know, having predictive modeling that can detect patients who might be at risk of hospital-acquired infections or you know, longer lengths of stay than normal, it can help target care to those who need it most. And obviously, when applied to telemedicine, it can help outsource, you know, treat patients in the home where it's much less expensive, obviously, than being at the ED or in the ICU. So there's lots of opportunities here, you know, to deploy it in a lot of different ways.
Well, Mike Milliard, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Mike Milliard is editor of Healthcare IT News. We've been talking about artificial intelligence and how it's transforming the healthcare industry. WSU is part of a statewide collaboration of public media broadcasters at work on an initiative called American Graduate, Getting to Work. The Corporation for Public Broadcast supports this campaign, and our conversation today is building on a larger one about how artificial intelligence and emerging technologies are changing the healthcare workforce. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The daily ritual of breaking bread can break a heart when a place at the table is empty because of a death. That's especially true among longtime couples. The same is true for the ritual of preparing a meal and everything that goes into how we consume our food in our society. New York Times food reporter Amelia Nierenberg this week wrote about how, for widows, the hardest part can be mealtime. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you wrote that there are triggers everywhere, that it isn't just that empty place at the table.
That's true. It's a story that I have wanted to do for a long time after seeing my grandmother and her friends struggle with learning how to cook and shop and eat alone after the death of their husbands or their wives. And every single element of food seems to be a reminder of grief and loss.
Even when somebody invites you out to dinner.
Especially when someone invites you out to dinner. More and more people are going out in couples, and then suddenly an even number group of eight becomes an odd number group of seven, and it can be devastating. People often stop going out.
Because then they have to go home alone.
Exactly, exactly. A lot of people spoke to me about the idea of driving home after a dinner, and just one woman spoke to me about missing her husband's hand on her leg when she was driving, and how that made her unable to go out and see her friends anymore.
And I suppose it's that person that you can deconstruct the night with and that kind of a thing.
Exactly, exactly. Processing together, mm-hmm. just telling someone about how your day went. That's all part of the grief that comes with food.
And then an interesting thing that came through in this was the whole idea of planning. And I thought, well, it's not about planning exactly what you're going to have, but it's just that conversation. It may be just a text saying, what do you want for dinner tonight?
It's exactly that. It's something that a lot of women spoke to me about, and men, just talking about walking through the grocery store and you're pushing your cart down familiar aisles, and people, to a person, people would stop in front of a food that only their partner liked and they didn't really care for, and have this moment of thinking, no one's here to eat it, but if I don't buy it, that is kind of a verification that they're not there anymore. And so the planning of mealtimes, people would often overbuy. they would often find themselves throwing out food that their partner wasn't there to eat anymore because they didn't know how to shop for one. It's in all aspects.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about what happens when you lose a partner, a spouse, and what happens at mealtime, what happens at snack time, what happens when you're talking about what you're going to have for dinner that night, or what happens to your breakfast time. My guest is Amelia Nierenberg. She's a food reporter for the New York Times. She wrote about this recently. We'll post a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have your own story to tell, we would love to hear it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if you went through this yourself and have come out the other side and figured out a way to you know, a strategy for dealing with it, all the better. Again, 614-292-8513. What sparked this article, Amelia?
So my grandfather died when I was 7, and for years my grandmother didn't want to cook. She would make food for me, you know, carrot sticks and grilled cheeses, but she used to be such a joyful cook, and until I was in high school, she didn't cook. And it's something that as a food reporter now at New Beat, I've been noticing in conversations with her friends, many of whom are elderly, and just a lot of people don't want to cook anymore. And it's something that seems to be a very widespread thing that no one is talking about. And I've spoken to quite a few bereavement counselors who will say the same things. Their patients are losing weight. Their patients are gaining weight. People are turning to processed dinners and TV dinners because, you know, you're sitting in your kitchen and your partner's sitting there with you. Maybe they do the dishes and you do the cooking, or they do the chopping and you do the serving, and suddenly you're doing it all by yourself. It just feels like a reminder.
And there is that health part of it. Some people are losing too much weight, some people are gaining too much weight, and they're eating too much junk.
Yes. I spoke to a widow who lives in South Carolina named Deborah Stevens, who has lost 71 pounds.
Wow.
A widow in Brooklyn, Marie Bright, has lost 16 pounds. People can't make their old clothes fit. So this tiny thing, you know, what you eat for dinner spirals into everything about your identity, what you wear, how your friends treat you. And then often a lot of times people deal with what it's like to be complimented on weight loss and have to conceal the reason for that weight loss because, you know, it's a hard thing to say. You look great. Well, thanks. My husband died. That doesn't really work.
My husband died and I quit eating.
Exactly. Exactly.
You wrote that academics and nonprofit groups only started paying attention to this relationship between grieving and food in the last decade. I'm wondering, what have they learned?
You know, there's been a lot of research on the ways that you can teach someone new tactics for cooking. One of the things that I did in this article was I got to go to a cooking class called Culinary Grief Therapy in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. And it's from an article that was published a couple years ago by a grief therapist called Heather Nickrand. And they've learned a lot. She's done a lot of studies about the ways that you can change recipe education, teach people different ways to shop, teach people different ways to express to friends that they will feel uncomfortable if they go out as couples. Maybe you could go out one-on-one. So it's a lot of work on trying to give people strategies to cope with the loss.
Let's see. Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. I just tuned in as you guys were talking about going out to a restaurant or something with and it touched on me because I have a neighbor who lost her husband about 3 or 4 months ago, and she's been through a lot of the immediate stuff and has settled a little bit. And my wife and I would sort of, I've been thinking about inviting her to go out to dinner with us, something we never did before. Just so we have a chance to chat and maybe talk about things other than her husband, but let that come up and, you know, just can it be friendly and things like that.
I think that's a great idea. Nice to meet you. One of the people I spoke to is a woman named Lori Burroughs Grad, and she said that she had been demoted to lunch, which is a quote. And the idea was that, you know, you used to be invited out as a couple among couples, but suddenly people don't think to invite you out to dinner because they're worried about making you sad. But I think that, you know, once you lose a partner, you're still the same person. You still have friends. I think she'd probably love that.
Steve, thanks a lot for that call. It's real so nice of you. Anybody else with your own thoughts, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Joanne in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Yes, Tom and I had been married 56 years, and he died suddenly. It's been 5 years now. But I can remember, as if it were yesterday, going to the store for the first time by myself, walking into the store and looking around and wondering why everybody was going around as if nothing had happened.
Mm. Yeah.
And so then I actually had to leave that time. I was better the second time, but I had to leave that time. But then I volunteer and I'm busy and, you know, I've my family, et cetera. But still planning meals you think about him a lot. I think about him a lot.
Did that surprise you, Joanne? And Joanne, I'm so sorry for your loss. It's always like 56 years. But
yeah, I'm a very independent person, and I'm you know wonderful independent, mm-hmm. and then you know that happened to me, and I wasn't used to that. That feeling was just such a terrible feeling of loss, and it still comes. You know, 5 years, and there are still things that just hit you. Television shows. I look at his chair and sometimes comment on things that I know he would like. But you do go on. But and then I hear women complaining about their husbands, and I don't say anything about it. But I just kind of think,
Yeah.
You know, I used to say the same things. You know, but it's different, and. It, you know, like I say, 5 years, but it'll never. That some of that will never go away, of course.
Yeah. How long was it before you could get back to the grocery store and feel comfortable?
Well, I needed to go because I'd had family here.
Because you had to eat.
Yeah, and so I just made a list and went to my list, but it was still. I was on the verge of crying for a couple times. I didn't cry. But I was on the verge of crying a couple times going to the grocery store. It was interesting. I never thought about that. But that was really very personal.
You know, when I was thinking about this program today, I was at the grocery store last night and I saw an older gentleman. He must have had like 6 or 7 boxes of bran flakes or something. I thought maybe this is a guy who's just trying to get his money, you know, so he doesn't have to come back. He doesn't want to come here. And it was a pretty big load of groceries, but I noticed all that cereal. And I wondered, Amelia, what did you learn about some of the strategies people use to re-enter safely?
I mean, yeah, I think that your strategy of using a list is one that a lot of people told me about where, you know, I know I need butter, eggs, eggplant, bread, ham, and then they went and just did that, went there. I think a lot of people spoke to me about going to the grocery store with support, taking mm-hmm. a friend, taking a loved one, and going through together. And a lot of people said, you know, you're just going to cry for a while because it's going to be really hard. One of the things that I learned in this article is that there's a real difference between grieving and mourning. Mourning is kind of a social activity. It's a ritual. You know, the funeral is part of the mourning. People bringing flowers is part of the mourning. It's something that people know how to do. But grieving is something that's much more personal and much more of a state of identity for a while. And so going to the grocery store is often a period an expression of mourning because it's a social activity. It's a ritual. You go every week, you do the same thing, and suddenly you're doing a different thing. But it's also tied into the emotional kind of reality of grief. Part of the reason it's so difficult is that it hits both registers.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. If anyone else wants to share their story, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the role of food in grieving today. My guest is Amelia Nierenberg. She's a food reporter for The New York Times. She wrote about this. And again, I'll put a link on our website to the article. It's at wosu.org/allsides. I wanted to go back to that culinary grief group in the Chicago suburb. Yeah. And one of the things that I kind of liked about it, and maybe I misread it, but just that they did some cooking together and actually did like food prep classes. And I thought that was kind of cool.
It's wonderful. They'll do Heather, who runs the program from a bereavement specialist perspective, works with two chefs, Laura and David. And they create menus and supermarket guides and all sorts of handouts so that people can think of ways to do a simple, minimal ingredient, in and out, 15-minute meal that they can make for themselves. And then they'll have these group dinners every couple of weeks where people, different groups will make, you'll make the salad and you'll make the meat and you'll make the vegetables and you'll make the dessert. So the whole group gets to taste at the end of the dinner, a 5 or 6 course offering, all of which they could make on their own with a recipe booklet.
It made me think about some neighbors, they do those kind of, now I'm blanking on what it's called, but where they kind of travel from house to house.
Yeah, traveling dinner.
Yeah, traveling dinners might be an interesting way to approach this too with neighbors.
It's very true. And then another thing that they do, which I think is really beautiful, is that they'll do a tasting vigil where each person will make one of their loved ones' favorite foods. One woman made empanadas, someone made a delicious chocolate cake, and they'll make those with a picture of their loved one next to their cooking station. Mm-hmm. And then everyone gets to go around, and this is something they do individually, but then the group gets to go around and try something that the person loved and share a story through. This is the time I had the cake on their birthday. We made these empanadas every day for our anniversary. This lasagna was just a quick and easy thing for the kids to get together. So it's a way for people to share the person that they've lost in celebration rather than in devastation.
And the group has released a book to help people cook again?
Yes, it's a part cookbook, part guide. It's available, I think, on Amazon.
What's it called?
I think it's called Culinary Grief Therapy Cooking for One series.
Okay, well, we'll try to find that and get a link for that for people who might be. What does it do? I mean, it just puts into book form the lessons from the Culinary Grief Group?
Yeah, it does that. It has a lot of really, really, really useful, straightforward recipes. I've been making them myself when my partner's out of town. And does a lot of, also has a lot of guidance and thoughts and stories. It's a lovely book. I'd recommend it highly.
Well, just getting it down, paring down the ingredients is helpful. The Jamie Oliver book, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's 5 ingredients,
right.
I think. And I love that thing. Plus, it's only for like maybe 2 or 3 people. It isn't for it to feed a cast of thousands.
Exactly. Which is rare in cookbooks. Most recipes are for 4, and these are intentionally portioned out for 1.
Right.
Which is really thoughtful.
It's called Culinary Grief Therapy Cooking for One series. So we'll find that and we'll put a link on our website to that.
That's wonderful.
How is the experience different for partners who weren't the main cook, especially older men?
It's very different. I went to a grief therapy group in the Bronx, that's in Bronx, New York, which is specifically for men. And a lot of people have to suddenly learn how to cook. Many of the men I spoke to went from their mother's cooking to their wife's cooking, and suddenly she's not there. One man I spoke to, Vince Calazzi, had been married to his wife for 46 years, and she died, and suddenly he needed to learn how to work his microwave. So for partners that aren't the main cook, I'm not going to say it's harder, but it's really hard. A lot of people end up spending a lot of money on takeout. It's pretty all-encompassing.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody who loved to cook at one point, there's the hope that they can return to that. And I was wondering if your grandma ever did.
You know, she did. She taught me how to cook when I was going away to college. We would spend much of the summer before I went to college going over recipes that I loved from my childhood. And I think that's a way that she and I were able to grieve my grandfather a second time. But yeah, she did learn to cook again, or she did start cooking again. It's something I'm very proud of her for.
So, you know, that's something to return to kind of
right.
as a ballast, but people who that for them, that wasn't their thing. They don't have that to return to. So
right.
what do they do? They learn how to cook?
Sometimes they have to. One man I spoke to in the same bereavement group would talk about how much his wife's absence were familiar tastes, and how, you know, she's been gone a while, and he still can't recreate favorite sauces or favorite stews because she didn't write anything down, and he doesn't know what she made, and that feels really devastating. But a lot of what the Culinary Grief Therapy Workshop does, and they teach seminars all over the country. There was just one that was hosted in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But one of the things they do is that they teach people who might not know what it means, the difference between bake and braise is, or the right way to chop, hold a knife, how to do that so that people can find a way forward. I spoke to a man in the Pacific Northwest, I'm forgetting his name right now, who is part of his grieving process is cooking his way through his wife's family's cookbook. Hmm. And sort of seeing her written notes on the margins has been helpful to him as well. So it's all over the place.
Yeah, whenever I see a cookbook at a garage sale that has lots of notes written in it and that kind of a thing, I always yeah. get it, because I just hate I can't imagine letting something like that go. There's so
no,
much humanity
true.
In there, you know?
Yeah.
You know, this also makes me think of the Meals on Wheels, and the folks I know who volunteer to deliver the meals often find that what the client really wants is some company. So
exactly.
what do grief
yeah.
counselors tell people about getting out and sharing a meal with others?
I mean, I think it's really encouraged. One of the folks I spoke to, she and her husband, her name is Jean, and she and her husband both worked at home. And so his absence in their home is really difficult. And her strategy for coping has been that she has someone over, or she goes out to dinner every night. And I think that having someone that you can just tell what you did that day, or you saw something funny on your drive to work, it's the daily thing of what a partner does for what you do for your partner.
Mm-hmm.
This woman I spoke to, Jean, she said to me, it isn't as though you spend every day making grand declarations of love for one another.
Right.
It's that daily conversation of, I'm going to the key food. What would you like me to pick up for you? And I think it's really true. And you have to find people who can share your days with you again, albeit in a very different way.
You know, when we were talking to Joanne earlier, and she so generously shared her story about kind of going yeah. to that grocery store for the first time, mm-hmm. and how she was, you know, a little shocked at, and I thought her way of putting that is like, why is everybody just acting like everything's normal? And I'm
right.
wondering, are grief counselors plugging into this and talking to people about, okay, this is going to happen, or this could happen?
Yeah, a quote that a lot of people have said to me is from C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed, which is a book he wrote after the death of his wife.
Right.
And it is her absence is like the sky spread over everything. And a lot of people would speak to me about going to the grocery store or the laundromat
mm-hmm.
As one of the first things they did after kind of the process of funeral and wake or shiva or whatever community grieving happened, and how they'd go in and realize, oh my goodness, no one else knows. Everyone else's lives are unaffected by this. How is everyone doing fine? Part of what grief counselors I've spoken to try and do is prepare their patients for, there will be ways that this hits you for months that you won't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just going to be true.
Well, Amelia Nirenberg, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Amelia Nirenberg is a food reporter for the New York Times. She wrote about food and grief. And I appreciate everybody who called in. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.